Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, inside China's Cultural Revolution, faction fighting in County Kerry, the legacy of the Irish Parliamentary Party in the days after independence, the journey of the Mayflower, and then to end the show, a novel set in East Germany in the days of the Stasi. Tonight, we begin with Agents of Disorder as we investigate China's Cultural Revolution.
In the summer of 1966, Chairman Mao called for students to attack intellectuals and officials who allegedly lacked commitment to revolutionary principles. And a new book poses the question of why did the Chinese party state collapse so quickly after the onset of the Cultural Revolution? And the award-winning author of China Under Mao offers a surprising answer that holds a powerful implicit warning for today's governments. The book is called Agents of Disorder, Inside China's Cultural Revolution. It's published in hardback by Belknap Press and costs £36.95 sterling, so about €40. The author is Andrew G. Walder. And Andrew, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me, Patrick.
Can we talk about the Cultural Revolution and the destruction and devastation that came with it? Because your book estimates that 1.6 million died. First of all, you're confident of that figure because there are many different accounts of how many were killed and how many died.
Yeah, well, originally I looked at the published accounts. I scored the number of deaths that were mentioned in more than 2,000 local histories in China. It took about 10 years. And I always assumed that they were underreporting the number of deaths. So I would compare, when I had internal classified government reports from the same place, I would compare them. When they were published provincial-level reports, I would compare them with the local reports. And I came up originally with a range of 1.1 to 1.6 million, trying to be conservative. Then after I'd published this paper, I came across an article in an obscure Hong Kong journal that described two central committee estimates that were always classified. The first one, done quickly, said there were 1.2 million deaths. The second one said 1.7. So that made me very confident that the number was really close to 1.6 million.
And it's very interesting that when you look at the Cultural Revolution, it's really a revolution from the top down rather than from the bottom up.
Well, it's a revolution from the top down, but most of the things that were published about this period emphasized what workers and students were doing, the way that students and workers attacked their leaders and beat them and sometimes killed them. And in the later phases, large coalitions of worker radicals and student radicals fought against one another, sometimes with arms, for almost 2 years. So most of what we originally thought about the death toll was created by a mass conflict. But what's very interesting about these officially published accounts, if you add them all together, is that 75%, three-quarters of all of the deaths that are documented in these accounts were done at the hands either of local governments or the military. And that makes sense in a certain way because the military and the government were much more organized and much better armed and trained. So when they put China back together again during 1968, the death toll for that came from quelling the disorders was much worse than the disorders themselves.
And that's what's so fascinating about the study, that the military intervention was mishandled so badly that it ended up causing more violence and generating more bloodshed.
That's absolutely right. And one of the reasons why the government collapsed so quickly was not because of a bottom-up rebellion by students and workers, but because party state officials themselves rebelled against their own superiors, because they realized that their superiors were going to fall in the campaign. And so they were trying to protect themselves. And the result of that was that there was a very fast wave of power seizures that overthrow county and city governments across China. Within 10 days, the last 10 days of January, 50% of all Chinese counties and cities were overthrown. And if we look carefully in these histories of who was doing the overthrowing, there were no students and workers active in most of these areas. It was the party state's own bureaucrats that overthrew their own leaders. Then the military came in, and what they found was that there were many different rebel groups who objected to the power seizures that were carried out often by the party state officials. And they were forced to choose winners and losers in this contest for power. And when they supported one side's argument, that side of the rebel movement became very closely tied to them. And the rebels who lost out by the military's decision became adamantly opposed to the military. And once the military realized it had a fight on its hands, it began to feed arms to the side of the rebel movement that supported it. And the other side that opposed the military raided arms depots and went to local militia stations and armed themselves, and off they went for almost 2 years of armed battles in China.
So what is the warning for today's governments? Is it that sometimes if you mishandle the cure, it can become worse than the disease?
Well, that's part of it. One is that repression can often feed on itself and multiply the number of victims far beyond what you may have anticipated. But I think the main warning is that a highly centralized government that tightly controls all of what its officials do, those officials are very, very sensitive to signals from the top. And when signals from the top become mixed or threatening, those officials may do things that are unanticipated. And so really what happened in early 1967, within about a six-week period, this very strong centralized party state unraveled very rapidly. And this was because the party state's own agents, its own officials, took actions that ended up undermining the government itself. So I think there's two warnings. And the second one, I think, that's more important, is that highly centralized regimes that look like you could never overthrow them are vulnerable from within. And when those local officials and local party loyalists start to change their minds, it's very difficult to hold things together.
Okay, well, Andrew, thanks a million for joining us tonight to discuss your new book, Agents of Disorder, Inside China's Cultural Revolution. It's published in hardback by Belknap Press and costs about €40. The author, Andrew Walter. And Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patrick, for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. On town streets or in green fields, at fairs, race meetings and saints' patron days, rival gangs of Irishmen used to meet to battle and beat each other with cudgels and sticks. And the story has now been told in a new book, Days of the Blackthorn, Faction Fighters of Kerry. It's published in paperback by Mercier Press and costs €16.99. The author is Sean Morahan. And Sean, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
It's really a quite remarkable story. And the fact that you would have so many joining in, the fact that you would have so many coming to watch, it was quite violent and it was quite bizarre, wasn't it?
Yeah, the most interesting thing about this is that on the one hand, it's bizarre, it's violent, and it's popular. So these are very unusual elements. In a sense, we can see that this is the violent pastime of a violent age, but it still strikes the modern reader as peculiar. Why did huge numbers of people meet to fight each other, to hit each other with sticks, and often to kill each other?
And it's something that hasn't really received the attention by historians before.
Yes, I think the bizarre nature of the activity meant that it was very difficult to quantify and difficult to understand. There are potentially different explanations for why people engaged in this activity. Sometimes it was to engage in or continue a grudge, and sometimes it was simply to give the fighters a sense that they were big men in their community about whom songs and stories could be written.
And it's interesting that there seems to be an organized nature to it in terms of the gangs that were there, because there were whole networks of farmers and followers and bring in relations, that there was a real organizational force behind this?
Yeah, the factions were run principally by strong farmers. And they brought in their friends, their extended family, allies and associates, and people who felt a sense of kinship with them. And they mustered what were, in effect, small armies against other farmers who mustered their armies of followers and friends. And they engaged quite happily and quite violently with each other at country fairs. So there was a huge element of organization, and a lot of factions were quite long-standing and functioned for decades, so sometimes maybe 50 or 60 years.
And Sean, your third chapter deals with one of these battles, and it was in a real sense a battle because you had about 2,000 people taking part, you had over 18 being killed, that these were deadly serious for those who were taking part and had tragic consequences for the community.
In every sense, it was a battle. These were unofficial battles fought during peacetime on Irish soil. Not only did you have armies, in a sense, massing and meeting each other, but you also got, as you often got with battles and conflicts and other, in a more formal sense, you got people who came along to watch and to see people attacking each other and to find out who would win the fight. So in every sense, these were battles, and the most famous battle, the Battle of Ballyhay, which took place in June 1834, was perhaps the most violent example of that.
Talk to me about Big Mick Foley and some of the big strong men who also had a prominent role to play in these kinds of fights.
Yeah, Mick Foley was a strong farmer of Killorglin. His family was unusual in that they had bought out their tenancy, and they therefore had a certain status as Catholic farmers within the community at a time when few others did. He himself was quite an unusual man. He was over 6 foot tall. He was described as being as of athletic frame, and he was famous for his strength, his size, his faction fighting ability, and his ability as a sportsman. And stories and songs about Big Mick were related in the community for 100 years after his death. So both during his lifetime and afterwards, he was a very important figure in popular culture. And he engaged mostly in the early decades of the 1800s, fighting at Kilgobnd Fair and at Puck Fair in Killorglin every August.
And finally, why did these things come to an end? Why did people eventually decide that this wasn't acceptable or that this wouldn't be allowed to happen?
I think that there was a sort of accretion of condemnation. From the beginning, faction fights had been condemned by the clergy. They had been condemned by Irish nationalist politicians. And over time, they eventually became less and less important in terms of the popular culture in the Irish countryside. The famine appears to have marked a sort of a break. And after that tragedy, faction fights, while they continued to exist, they weren't as frequent and they weren't as notable as before. And with the arrival of the land war in the 1880s, farmers' energies were directed in a more sort of political direction, and the simultaneous arrival of the GAA into Irish life from 1884 onwards meant that there were other things to divert men's energies. And from that period onwards, the faction fights began to decline.
Okay, well, Sean, congratulations on the book. It's called Days of the Blackthorn: Faction Fighters of Kerry. It's published in paperback by Mercier Press and costs €16.99. The author, Sean Moran. And Sean, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book provides the first detailed analysis of the influence of former Irish Parliamentary Party members and methods in independent Ireland, and looks at the place of the party's leaders in public memory. The book is called The Legacy of the Irish Parliamentary Party in Independent Ireland, 1922 to 1949. It's published in hardback by Liverpool University Press. The author is Martin O'Donoghue. And Martin, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
It's a fascinating study because usually when we think of the Irish Parliamentary Party, we usually stop thinking about them once you hit the 1918 general election, and we never really examine what happened to them after independence.
I think that's the case. And certainly when I was studying history as an undergraduate, one of the things that struck me looking at Irish politics, particularly of the interwar period, was the sense to which, particularly when you looked at Shannon debates and Dáil debates, was there a sense that there were these politicians who didn't necessarily come from either side of what's sometimes seen as the Civil War divide. And particularly looking at Shannon debates coming up to the emergency in the late 1930s, I was struck by arguments around Frank McDermott and some other senators who seem to have a home rule heritage rather than, let's say, a traditional Sinn Féin background. So that was the genesis of the project, if you like, and the book, and what I was trying to achieve, and looking at how did they react to independence, to what extent did they join new parties, or did they hold aloof, and also how was the Irish Party remembered on a state that looked back towards the sacrifice of the 1916 Rising? How were people like John Redmond, Charles Stuart Parnell, and Michael Davitt commemorated in the state?
So let's try and answer some of those questions. So after 1922, how did they feel about the new state? Did they feel dispossessed, or did they feel that they could coalesce with any of the new political parties?
Traditionally, the leadership of the party was held by John Redmond, of course, John Dillon, T.P. O'Connor, who was an MP for Liverpool, and Joe Devlin from Belfast. So there was a change in political circumstances after 1918, where O'Connor continued as an MP in Liverpool, Devlin maintained a role in Northern nationalism. And then in the Free State, John Dillon, for example, certainly did seem to feel quite dispossessed. And older MPs like himself tended to look on from the sidelines, if you like. However, others found ways to accommodate themselves. So in 1918, of course, Sinn Féin did absorb support from the Irish Parliamentary Party. And in 1922, many former Home Rulers looked on the treaty settlement as a reasonable settlement and an end to violence. So you see a certain movement towards the independent benches of the new Dáil, where parliamentary representation had been expanded. Obviously, there were more TDs than there had been MPs going to Westminster. And you had a certain element of Home Rule support finding its way into Cumann na Gael, the Farmers' Party, Labour, and others. But it was often a difficult transition. And that's represented, I think, by the fact that John Redmond's son, Captain William Redmond in Waterford, he turns down an invitation to stand for Cumann na Gael. He's elected as an independent TD. Alfie Burns elected as an independent TD, a former MP, as is James Cosgrave in Galway. So there are many of them that do feel quite awkward about taking on new party labels. And it's specific pressure points that force them to do so, whether that's accepting the treaty, whether that's the economic war in the 1930s, or in the middle of the 1920s, there's an attempt to revive the Irish Parliamentary Party in the Free State in the form of the National League. And when that collapses, it's another moment where former Home Rulers have to try to come to an accommodation with one of the newer parties.
The Irish Parliamentary Party had a great tradition of activity and organising in the different constituencies. I wonder, did any of that continue in the new independent state, and did it have an influence on the new parties that were emerging?
That's an interesting question. Certainly, former Home Rulers found their way into all parties. So one of the findings of the book is that in the 1930s and 40s, between 30 and 40% of Fine Gael TDs have some form of Home Rule heritage in their background. And that's quite a significant legacy that finds its way into Fine Gael from the 1930s onwards. However, looking at the 20s, 30s and 40s, there are people with Home Rule backgrounds in all parties. And the irony, perhaps, is that the outstanding political organisation of this period, and the most successful one, is Fianna Fáil. So Fianna Fáil seemed to absorb far fewer individuals with links to the old party than its main rival, Fine Gael. But Fianna Fáil, in its ability to build constituency organisations around the country, and as people have looked at the idea of De Valera as a leader that derives a strong obedience and a very strong parliamentary discipline and whip system that Fianna Fáil seems to master better than its rivals, has an echo of the old parliamentary party of Parnell, of course, where he was the unquestioned chief.
It's interesting what you mentioned there about the connection with Fine Gael and the way Fine Gael seems to have absorbed so many who had the parliamentary party background. Did that change Fine Gael, or who was influencing who in this period?
So Home Rulers tended to coalesce into Fine Gael by the 1930s. They didn't do so immediately. And they did find it difficult in the early 1920s. Cumann na Gael and later Fine Gael, I argue, remained Sinn Féin parties. So were former home rulers, they were not shut out from Irish public life. Certainly not. When you see that John Redmond's son, Captain William Redmond, is a TD, his widow Bridget Redmond's a TD, and indeed James Dillon, son of John Dillon, would end up as a Fine Gael leader in the 1950s and 60s. But when home rulers are not shut out from Irish public life, it's only when they join with those from Sinn Féin backgrounds that they come near to real political power. So unquestionably, they do influence perceptions of Fine Gael. And when Fine Gael is formed, of course, along with the formation of the Centre Party that have been led by James Dillon and Frank McDermott, the Blue Shirt Movement and Cumann na Gael, Fianna Fáil poke fun at this. They call it the Cripple Alliance. And they highlight the so-called pro-British or home rule links of people like Dillon and McDermott alongside people from Sinn Féin backgrounds like W.T. Cosgrave. So it does problematise the image of Fine Gael and it's used by its opponents. But at the same time, the attempts to revive the Irish Parliamentary Party in the National League in 1927 don't succeed. Dillon and McDermott, National Centre Party, which is primarily a farmers' party, ultimately has to form an alliance with those from pro-treaty backgrounds. So it's only when they can form alliances with politicians from Sinn Féin backgrounds that they come near to real political power and that they get to enter government.
You mentioned commemoration, and I'm wondering how they remembered, and even if they commemorated people like Redmond, and going further back, Parnell.
The commemoration of the Irish Parliamentary Party is interesting, and the Irish Party is historicised in this period in different ways. And what I mean by that is that in the 1920s, the immediate aftermath of the party's defeat, John Redmond and the later Irish Party is actually commemorated in quite a dramatic and quite a popular way. So there's major commemorations of John Redmond in 1924 and 1925 in Wexford and indeed in Waterford as well. And there's commemorations of his brother, Willie Redmond, in Clare. And these commemorations are not attended or the speeches are not given by Cosgrave or the Free State leaders, but they're speeches given by John Dillon, Joe Devlin, and former Irish Party members and supporters attend. And it's over 20,000 people come to Wexford in 1924. So there are major commemorative moments. And in many ways, these commemorative activities are a forerunner to the political activities of former MPs and forming the National League in 1926. However, after that, the memory of Redmond and the later Irish Party goes into decline, particularly in the 1930s. And in the 1930s and 40s, it's Parnell and Michael Davitt and the earlier Irish Parliamentary Party of the land war period that is better remembered. It wouldn't be true to say that they're remembered on the same scale as those leaders of 1916 and the War of Independence, but there is a sense in the 1940s, particularly in 1941, which is the 50th anniversary of Parnell's death, and in 1946, where there are centenaries, Parnell and Davitt, that there's a sense to which the land war generation can be subsumed into a narrative which culminates in the Irish Revolution, and that Redmond and the Irish Party at this point are remembered in opposition to the victors of the Irish Revolution, and that sees them in a place of neglect where De Valera and others speak at commemorations of Parnell and Davitt.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Martin, congratulations on the book, a superb new study. It's called The Legacy of the Irish Parliamentary Party in Independent Ireland, 1922 to 1949. It's published in hardback by Liverpool University Press. The author, Martin O'Donoghue. And Martin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. This year sees the 400th anniversary of the sailing of the Mayflower, the ship that took the Pilgrim Fathers to the New World. It's a foundational event in American history, but it began as an English story, which pioneered the idea of religious freedom. And the story has now been retold in a brilliant new book, The Journey to the Mayflower, Gods, Outlaws and the Invention of Freedom. It's published in hardback by Hodder and Stoughton and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. And I'm delighted to welcome the author, Stephen Tompkins, to the show tonight. Stephen, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Can we begin with, I suppose, the story of why they decided to leave 400 years ago? What was the driving force?
What they really wanted was religious freedom, although that was what made them leave England. But they left England originally for the Netherlands rather than from North America. The reason why they had to leave the Netherlands was a little more complicated, and it's not entirely clear. But they faced persecution in England because they were Protestant dissenters. They wanted to run their own churches in their own way, and that was illegal at that time. Everyone had to belong to the Church of England. So they were rounded up. They were put in prison. Their leaders were executed. And for their own safety and freedom, they had to go to the Netherlands. And they seemed to have a pretty reasonable life in the Netherlands. Life was hard for them. They were immigrants. They had to learn new skills. But they managed and they got by. So I think the reason why they left the Netherlands and then went to North America was they had this key idea that God was leading them to his promised land. And originally they thought in leaving England and going to the Netherlands, they might have this holy community. But it was too much of a struggle. It was not everything that they dreamed of. And so they started to look elsewhere. Where could God be leading them next? Maybe the Netherlands was just the wilderness that they had to get through to reach the promised land. And so they came up with this idea that America was this uncharted continent that God was leading them to, and that was the real promised land that was their ultimate destination, where they would be able to worship God in freedom and truth.
And it's interesting the way they were viewed as a threat by the English establishment.
They absolutely were. It's quite hard for us, I think, these days to get our minds back into the way that religion worked in the Elizabethan period in England, the way that it was utterly expected by everyone on all sides that there would be this one church that united the entire population, and every person in the country was expected to belong to that church because that was one of the ways that the monarch ruled the country. And the idea that people could leave the church and set up their own churches, it was like saying, I'm going to leave the law of England, or I'm going to leave the government of England and set up my own community with my own laws and do things my own way. People were afraid that if everyone was allowed to believe what they wanted to believe and churches were allowed to teach what they wanted to teach, then the Queen would lose control of the church and church would lose control of society and then civilization would collapse. They really took it as seriously as that.
Very good. So when we look at the kind of the meetings they were having, what were they like? Is there a sense of how they gathered and what it would have been like to be someone there?
Yes, well, of course, they were illegal, so they had to meet secretly and try to avoid detection. So they would meet sometimes in the upper rooms of pubs, sometimes in private rooms. They would meet on ships, or if the weather was okay, out in the woods and the fields. And they would worship and pray together for many hours. It would be really the whole of Sunday that they would spend together like this. And despite the fact that they were trying to keep it secret, they could be quite noisy affairs. There were complaints from neighbors about them groaning and sighing and making a big kerfuffle in their prayers. But they were also very democratic affairs. You know, the Church of England was it was a monarchy, really. It was ruled absolutely by the Queen through her bishops, and they had control of everything that went on. And people were just expected to turn up to the Church of England churches and, you know, just sit through the service. But in these underground churches, they had much more freedom. And so, although sometimes they elected ministers, it was always open to everyone to take part. And so one person would pray, another person would read out of the Bible, and anyone who felt like it, anyone who felt that they had a calling, could stand up and preach to everyone else. And other people could interrupt to ask questions or even to challenge what was being said. So it was far more free and democratic than what was happening in the state church.
And I think people will be surprised that first they went to the Netherlands and then why they left the Netherlands and went on then to America.
Well, they had previously tried Scotland, but they had found Scotland to be much like England, and they were arrested in Scotland and put in prison. I thought, if we're going to face this trouble in Scotland, we might as well go home. But in the Netherlands, there was a freedom of religion that didn't exist in England, a freedom of religion for Protestants. So the Dutch Republic was fighting for its independence from the Spanish Empire, the Catholic Spanish Empire. And so the government of the Netherlands under William the Silent, William of Orange, decided that it was, rather than trying to impose one brand of Protestantism on the whole nation, it was more important that all the Protestants could get together and accept each other and fight on the same side. So for that kind of pragmatic reason, as well as from a belief in freedom, Prince William decreed complete toleration for all Protestant sects in the Netherlands. And so Reformed and Anabaptists and various other Protestant groups were able to worship in freedom so that they could present a kind of united front to the Catholics. And so it was much easier for people from other Protestant countries to come and mingle among them and set up their own churches, because they had a variety already which simply wasn't tolerated in England, but it's the way that things were in the Netherlands because they were fighting for their freedom.
And then the decision to leave for there, was there a feeling that they had that this was their destiny?
Yes, absolutely. I think that we need to try to grasp just how deeply ingrained it was for them to see their own story in terms of the Bible story, particularly the story of Exodus, where God led the children of Israel out of slavery in Egypt through the wilderness to the Promised Land. And the separatists believed that they were the new children of Israel because they were the new church of God. They were the followers of God. And so God was doing with them now what he did with his children of Israel in the Bible times. And so they looked for a pattern to follow, and they found it in the Exodus. And so they believed that just as God led through Moses the children of Israel out of Egypt through the wilderness in the Promised Land, God was going to lead them out of the land of slavery, which was England, where they were suffering and imprisoned. And he was going to lead them to the Promised Land, wherever that might be. They didn't know. And first they thought it might be the Netherlands. But when the Netherlands wasn't working out for them, they had to rethink and think, well, God led the children of Israel through the wilderness into the Promised Land. So we are going through the wilderness now. God must be leading us eventually to the Promised Land. And they came to see America in that light. And they, you know, it was a dangerous journey, and they were fully aware of the risks that they were going to face, but they believed that God would be with them.
Very good. Well, it's a fascinating story. It's called The Journey to the Mayflower, God's Outlaws and the Invention of Freedom. It's published in hardback by Hodder and Stoughton and costs about €24. The author, Stephen Tompkins. And Stephen, thanks a million for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. What was it really like to take the Art Deco Coronation Streamliner from King's Cross to Edinburgh, to cross the Atlantic by the Normandy, to fly with Imperial Airways from Southampton to Singapore, to steam from Manhattan to Chicago on board the New York Central's 20th Century Limited, or to dine and sleep aboard the Graf Zeppelin? Well, in a new book, The Journey Matters, Jonathan Glancy travels from the early 1930s to the turn of the century on some of the most glamorous and romantic trips of the century. And as I say, the book is called The Journey Matters, 20th Century Travel in True Style, published in hardback by Atlantic Books. It costs £20 sterling, so about €24. And Jonathan, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed.
I get the sense from reading the book that you're someone who loves travelling themselves. Is that right?
I love travelling very much indeed, but like many people over the last few decades, I found that the sort of travel that I can afford, which is not those grand trains and ships you mentioned earlier, which are all in the book, the ones I can afford are so banal and dreary and dull today. And there's a lovely quote. I remember Al Gore, the former vice president of the States, said that airplane travel today is nature's way of making you look like your passport photograph. And I kind of sums it up in a way.
Whereas, of course, in the past, there was something glamorous about flying and people would dress up for it. And that's the sense from these great journeys that there was part of the adventure of the trip was the getting there.
It is the adventure. That's it. Patrick, it's the romance, the poetry of travel that I think has so often lost out in the last few decades. And although people might say, Jonathan, now don't be silly, because today travel is much safer. Think of those aeroplanes of the past. They weren't that safe, were they? And today we can travel, might be anodyne fashion, but we get from A to B, you know, safe and sound. And that, there's a certain truth in that, of course. But there's a kind of dullness. You know, when you get on a plane these days, everybody's crammed into economy class. Or you get on a long-distance train and you're sitting under fluorescent lights, but they're like something out of a, you know, an operating theatre or a dentist's studio. And you think, why is this being done to us? Why are we being treated in such an unkind way? When many of us do dream, and it is dreaming today, a lot of it, of travelling in style. And so what I've done in this book is to put myself back onto some of those journeys. So in a sort of half fiction, half reality, to say, I wonder what it really would have been like. You know, what do things sound like, smell like? How did people talk? What did they eat? You know, what was it truly like being on some of those great journeys of the past century?
So let's go back then and try and recreate some of those great journeys. So let's take, for example, rail travel. If you were in a first-class carriage on one of these journeys, what would you have enjoyed? What might you have enjoyed?
Oh, gee whiz. First-class travel was certainly first-class in the late 1930s. That was the era of the great streamline trains, both in Britain and the United States in particular. And what you'd have noticed, say you got on a train either at King's Cross or at Grand Central New York, and you're going to Edinburgh or you're going to Chicago, as you got on the train, somebody would have, you know, taken you on board. A steward would have invited you on board, brought you to your seat, and your seat would be an individual armchair. And straight away it would be, and what would you like to drink, sir or madam? And then the cocktail would arrive, the great era of cocktails. And that's just the start. The menus arrive, everything done in perfect style, the napery, the cutlery, what you ate, all fresh cooked on board, real kitchens, real food taken on board as the train moved along, stopped at stations, more fresh food coming on. So all that, I think, is just very, very glamorous way of travelling, comfortable, charming, and a world where you were treated with great, not compassion so much, as you were treated with great respect. And I think that's something a lot of us don't feel today. You know, having said that, some of the journeys, by the way, which I think are truly glamorous, and I think that's part of the point of the book, are these very everyday journeys that third class, and my favourites, by the way, are in Ireland, which we should talk about.
Very good. So what about sea travel then? Was that the most popular choice if you had to go on a long journey? And what was it like if you were on one of those iconic cruise liners or ships?
Well, they weren't cruise liners, remember. They were ocean liners. And the difference is a cruise liner today is a floating hotel that potters around, you know, nice warm seaports around the world. But ocean liners were in a hurry. You know, they were like express trains or high-speed aircraft, except on the sea. So those great liners like the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth and the Normandy, which I write about, the French liner in the book from the mid-1930s, boy, they went fast. Try and imagine yourself on a speedboat that weighs 80,000 tons, and that's, get some idea of what they were like. You know, they weren't poshing around, but they were luxurious hotels at the same time with staggering, beyond first class travel inside them. And so you'd have been looked after very well indeed. And on the Normandy, for instance, when you went to the dining room, you walked into this great hall of glass, beautiful Tiffany glass everywhere, columns made of glass, in a room that was bigger than the Hall of Mirrors at the Palace of Versailles outside Paris. So this is the epic scale we're talking about. And style all the way down, right through, you know, to your napkin, to a box of matches you picked up to light your cigar. Everything designed, all of a piece, all in harmony.
What about the Graf Zeppelin then? If you were to take a journey on that, how luxurious and indeed how safe would you have felt?
Well, isn't that strange? The poor old Zeppelins had a very bad reputation later on because the great Hindenburg famously exploded in New Jersey, killing all on board. And that was because it was filled with hydrogen gas, because the Americans wouldn't sell the Germans, the Nazi Germans, by then, the helium gas they needed. So hydrogen, of course, goes bang if you light it, and helium, of course, is an inert gas which you put in your children's party balloons and, of course, won't cause an explosion at all. So, but the Graf Zeppelin, the earlier big Zeppelin, the first flew in 1929, crossed the Atlantic many, many times and never had an accident. The thing is, though, which is interesting, it only carried 20 passengers. So can you imagine that? This huge thing, it's 1,000 foot long as that Normandy ocean line that we talked about, but just 20 people as opposed to 1,000, 2,000 people on board. So the fares were extraordinarily expensive. And you traveled, though, of course, you weren't traveling with people going on holiday. You were traveling with professional people, government people, you know, really serious VIPs, as it were, in today's terms. And they wanted to travel quickly across the Atlantic, and they could do this on this great airship. But I do think the strange thing about them, they must have been slightly claustrophobic, because you were up in this fairly small public cabin and berths for 4 days. So, interesting. But people liked, I think, the challenge, and the people you met on board were really so interesting that you'd have wonderful conversations on the way.
So if you could go back in time and take any one of these iconic journeys, having researched them all, what one would you take?
Londonderry and Lough Swilly Railway from Londonderry to Burtonport on the Wild West Donegal coast. One of the most romantic railways I think that's ever existed, running through the Donegal landscape, absolutely stunning, and serving, though, each railway station serving villages that are about 5 miles away from the stations. And this glorious sort of not quite useless railway, but so charming, so romantic. That today, this closed in 1940, by the way, the railway there, and there are no railways in Donegal now, sadly. But when that, if that railway had survived, say, another 15, 20 years, it would be preserved. And imagine today, people from all over the world would come to Derry to travel to Burtonport across Donegal by this most beautiful steam railway with all its charm and some of the most glorious landscapes in Europe.
Okay, well, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us tonight to recreate some of those brilliant journeys with us. The book is called The Journey Matters, 20th Century Travel in True Style. It's published in hardback by Atlantic Books and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author, Jonathan Glancy. And Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much indeed. Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. The award-winning novelist David Young is responsible for a brilliant series of novels that have been praised for capturing the mood of East Germans in the 1970s, fearful yet also proud. And the fifth in the series has just been published in paperback by Zafra. It costs £7.99 sterling, so about 10 or 11 euro. It's called Stasi Winter, and I'm delighted to welcome David to the show tonight. David, you're very welcome.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Can I talk about the inspiration for this series? Because it has been a huge success. It's won numerous awards. What prompted you to start researching crimes in what was East Germany and then turning them into these brilliant novels?
Well, it was a bit of a strange one, really. I was looking for something that was a niche idea, something that hadn't been done before. And when I was on a creative writing master's at City University in London, where my tutor actually was Claire McGowan, who's a Northern Irish crime writer, and we had to do a chapter on setting. And I came up with this idea about setting it in East Berlin, doing a chapter set in East Berlin. And actually, that was inspired by a little tour my indie pop band had done to Germany probably about 5 years before that. And most of the places that booked us were clubs in the east of Germany. And then between gigs, I was studiously reading Anna Funder's Stasiland while my bandmates were quaffing alcohol and various other substances.
And so from there came this great series. How much research did you have to do in terms of trying to access archival material about the secret police, about the East German government, and how difficult was it to research?
Well, I didn't, because it's fiction, I didn't make efforts to go into the Stasi archive, although you can do that. But what I've done is made contacts with former East German detectives. So, for instance, my second book, Stasi Wolf, was set in Halle Neustadt, and I got in touch with the head of the murder squad, former head of the murder squad there, who solved one of East Germany's most famous cases, the crossword puzzle murder. And he gave me a tour of his old patch, talked about that case. And then another, I suppose, rich vein for me were memoirs written in German. And unfortunately, when I started all this, I didn't really speak German other than to order a beer or a hotel room. So what I had to do was buy these memoirs, written in German, tear out the pages, feed them through my scanner, and turn them into Google Translate, Microsoft Word documents that I could then put through Google Translate. So you can imagine there was a lot of gobbledygook came out, but you could still get the basic gist of the facts. In terms of actually talking to former Stasi agents firsthand, you don't really need to do that because there's plenty of material on YouTube. And if you look up interviews with former Stasi agents, you'll find that almost to a man, they are unrepentant about what they did because they feel they were defending the revolution and defending socialism in East Germany. And without their actions, East Germany would have ceased to exist.
And David, in terms of developing and inventing your character of Major Karen Müller, who's been the star of the series, why was there a particular real-life figure you decided to base her on?
No, I didn't particularly base it on any one woman. She's a combination, I suppose her character traits are a combination of women I've known. But I particularly wanted to have a lead female character, because at the time when I started writing in 2013, that was something a little bit different. Obviously, nowadays, I think there's a lot more female leads written by male authors. But also, it reflects East German life, because women in the 1970s, when my series started, had a much greater role in the workplace in East Germany than they did in the West. Something like 90% of East German women were in work, and that was reflected in the police. There was many female detectives, but what there weren't were female leaders of murder squads. So that's a bit of a fiction.
Is this going to be the final word on her investigations, or might you be tempted to continue her story?
There is one more which I'm writing at the moment. The Stasi game, which is due out in October, and I guess that's more of a spy story. It's set in Dresden in the early 1980s, but it's also got links to Britain, and one of the main characters in it is British, and there is a spying element involving MI6. So it's something a little bit different. That's due out in October. My publishers say that is it for the series, but they have commissioned me to start another series, which will be set in my home city of Hull, where I was born, and that's a crime story set during the Hull Blitz of the 1940s, the Second World War.
And that was David Young talking to us about his brilliant new novel set in East Germany in the days of the Stasi. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we'll be looking at the life and work of Rembrandt, and we'll be debating how he transformed the world of visual art. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.